Космос. Последний рубеж. Это путешествие подкаста The Big Bird Theory. Его миссия – каждый четверг делиться новостями науки и вместе с вами открывать новые горизонты знаний. Смело идти там, где еще не ступала нога человека.
Бороды того времени суток, дорогие друзья, вы слушаете 122 выпуск подкаста «Теория Большой Бороды», самого научно-космического аудиошоу на территории русскоязычного интернета. Меня зовут Антон Поздняков, а наш подкаст выходит на сайтах birdycast.com вместе с нашим основным подкастом об IT, технологиях и медиакультуре. И также «Теория Большой Бороды» выходит на сайте ITC.UA. Сегодня будет весьма необычный выпуск, он сразу в двух версиях, и все потому, что к нам пришел англоязычный гость. И для тех, кто хочет послушать английскую версию, вы находитесь сейчас в нужном месте. Далее выпуск будет продолжен на английском языке. Если же вы недостаточно уверенно чувствуете себя с английским, то специально для вас мы сделали русскоязычную версию. Ее вы можете найти в соседнем подкасте, либо в фиде, в котором вы слушаете нас через мобильное приложение, либо же, если вы слушаете нас с сайта, то чуть выше или чуть ниже будет расположен плеер с ссылкой на скачивание нужного вам файла. Там все переозвучено, все на русском языке, но я же все же хочу вам посоветовать, если вы чувствуете в себе уверенность, послушать оригинальную версию. Что ж, надеюсь, вам понравится этот выпуск. Переходим непосредственно к интервью с Брайаном.
Okay, so today in this episode, which is, as you can hear, is English speaking, I'm joined by a very interesting guest. His name is Brian. Hi, Brian.
Hello.
Yeah, and Brian is basically a astronaut candidate, which sounds super fun. So can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you actually got to the point where you started thinking about, oh, I want to become an astronaut?
Well, I've wanted to be an astronaut for as long as I can remember, maybe since the age of 2 or 3 years old. It wasn't really realistic initially because I didn't have most of the qualifications that NASA looks for. But then the space program started to become privatized and there started to be opportunities that just didn't exist before. And thankfully, it all worked out.
So we're talking about a private firm that basically does astronaut training.
We're talking about a couple of different ones. The mission that I'm going to be flying is technically classified as a commercial space mission, but it's NASA supported. Most of the instructors come from NASA. We have astronauts, I guess former astronauts would be the correct term, who do a lot of the instruction, and NASA's handling a lot of the funding for the project.
Mm-hmm. So the actual thing is called Astronauts for Hire, right?
That was where I initially got into the commercial space program. They recently reformed under a new name, the Association of Spaceflight Professionals. I did my first year of training with them, and then I was eventually accepted for a mission through Project Possum, and for the last 2 years I've been training with Project Possum.
Okay, so you're saying that it's actually backed by NASA, but what's the point for NASA to do that? Because they have their own astronaut training, and they have all those qualifications that are needed that most people do not pass, as you said. So why are they doing that? Why are they going for a commercial one?
Well, I don't really know what the official reason is. If I had to guess, I would think that it allows them to cover more ground this way, because NASA has limited resources. They've gone through a lot of budget cuts over the last several years, and so this allows them to, rather than having to focus on one thing, they can do a lot of different things.
Okay, so who is participating in that then? So who are the members of the candidate crew?
Well, there are a lot of different ones. My graduating class, there were 12 of us from all over the world. Really differing personalities. We've got several people who are military. There's at least one who's from NASA. We've got another guy. He's a really interesting person. He had just finished climbing Mount Everest at the time that he joined, and he's getting ready to roll across the Atlantic.
Wow. And are there any qualifications that you need to have to join? Because, well, I think there are, because that's an obvious thing to do. You don't just accept anybody from the street. So, and what are the qualifications needed, and how are they different from the NASA ones?
Well, it's kind of funny you ask that. even with NASA, their main qualification that they look for is just a bachelor's degree in a STEM-related field. And it's kind of the same thing with Project Possum. But of course, you know, that's not really enough to get you in the door. That's just the bare minimum. They don't really tell you why you were chosen, so I have no idea which qualification it is that they looked at.
Okay, so can actually anybody be accepted? Or, well, at least, can anybody apply to this whole thing?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Like I said, I have no idea what their criteria is for making a selection, but it's open to where anybody can apply for it.
Mm-hmm. So let's move to through the actual training then, because I think that's the most interesting part. Because when you know, I assume everybody has seen at least some videos of astronaut training with all the pool scuba diving and rescuing from a broken plane or shuttle or whatever training you have. So can you please tell us a bit, like, what things did you have to go through to actually get ready for that? Probably in the chronological order. So what did you start with, and like, what did you do next, and how it all advanced?
Okay, well, there's been a lot of it. Like I said, I've been training for the last 3 years. One of the really interesting things about the way that they do it is that you're not necessarily required to take things in a specific order. You just have to get it all done at some point. The order is kind of irrelevant. For me, probably the first thing that I did was spacesuit training. And then after that, I did centrifuge, where you learn to cope with G-forces. That was really cool, because in a lot of the space movies, the centrifuge is kind of like a tin can. But the modern one that they use at the National Aerospace Training and Research Center, on the inside, it's a mock-up of the vehicle, so it looks and feels like a space launch. You have all the out-the-window views, you have the roar of the rocket engine. It's quite the experience. Let's see, I've also done sea survival training. Let's see, lots of aerobatic flight. Gosh, trying to even remember everything. There have been quite a few zero-gravity flights.
So do they actually involve NASA's facilities? Or is it privately owned? Is it privately built?
We use a lot of different facilities. We don't really use many NASA facilities. Most of them are either private or university. We do a lot with Embry-Riddle University. They have an advanced simulations lab where they've got a full-scale mock-up of the spacecraft that we're training on, and they've got a mock-up of mission control. So we can do full-blown mission rehearsals right there.
Okay, so, and what sort of spacecraft is it?
Originally, this mission was supposed to have been done on the X-Core Lynx, but there were some problems with the Lynx, so we're going to be using Virgin Galactic Spaceship 2 instead.
Mm-hmm. So, is it actually officially classified as an orbital mission, or is it suborbital?
No, it's suborbital. We are going to be launching from northern Alaska, Ellison Air Force Base, and the mission is going to be to study polar mesospheric clouds. So after launch, we're going to actually do a cloud penetration. These are really high, thin clouds. They're roughly 85,000 feet up, and they form over the poles for just a couple of weeks during the summer each year. And they haven't been thoroughly studied yet, so that's the main reason for the mission. We're going to penetrate those, take some samples, and do some tomography of the clouds. So that's kind of the mission goal.
So it's like mostly a scientific experiment, right?
Yes.
And what sort of people are involved? Because I assume there will be a scientist also in it, but do you have pilots as well, or actually trying to control the whole ship, or is it?
Yes, Spaceship 2 holds 8 people, so there are going to be 2 pilots and 6 scientists on these flights. I'm going to be flying as a scientist, but I'm actually going to go for simulator training to learn how to fly it in October. My role in this isn't going to be to fly it, but just kind of a backup skill, and at least by knowing how to fly it, I can help out with the training too.
Okay, and just to cover it for our listeners, so what kind of background do you personally have, scientific or maybe so it's not only about, you know, what degree did you get, but also like what did you do to come up to this point?
Well, I can tell you, even though the mission is about polar mesospheric clouds, I knew nothing about that going in. I've had to learn all of the science since I was accepted into the program. My background is actually in computer science. I've worked in computer science in one form or another since the age of 16. I used to be a CIO for a chain of hospitals. I was in charge of the computer network for the Department of Defense at Fort Knox for a while. And I was a network administrator for some large insurance companies. And since about the year 2000, I've been full-time technical writing and speaking. So that's kind of my background.
Okay. And was it hard to study the climate thing and to actually get into that? Because, well, that's probably not the simplest thing to do.
Yeah. The science I didn't really have too much trouble with. It was relearning all of the math that I hadn't touched since college. That was a bit more of a challenge.
That's painful to relearn the math because you have to dig deep into yourself. I can tell that. I sometimes have to do that. That's painful.
There are a lot of academics involved in commercial space training, and I did a class last year on orbital mechanics, and that's pretty much nothing but math.
Mm-hmm. Did you actually... Well, I know you did, but just for the sake of conversation, I'm asking you the question that... did you release a book on that? Because, well, I know you did.
Yeah, I wrote a really short book on it. It's kind of an introduction to rocket science and orbital mechanics. It uses some math, but I stayed away from the calculus and tried to keep it easy to follow.
Well, I think, telling complicated things in plain language is quite a skill. Basically, that's what we're trying to do in this podcast, by the way. But can you actually play Kerbal Space Program after reading your book properly?
Yeah, it certainly couldn't hurt to list that on an application, but just reading a book that's an introduction to orbital mechanics isn't enough to qualify you to join the space program.
No, I was asking about the Kerbal Space Program, the computer game.
Oh, I'm not familiar with that.
Oh, that's a cool one. You have to, you have those little Kerbal people, and it's basically an orbital mechanics simulator, which is, I think it's really fun. I haven't played it much though, but I know it's a huge cult among space enthusiasts. I think you should check it out if you haven't yet. It's a really fun one, and it has a lot of mods where you can actually simulate actual Earth conditions and put things into orbit and do all the crazy stuff. But coming back to the program you're in, so the question I want to ask is, how many people actually involved in that? And is the mission you're doing the only mission that will be out there?
The mission that I'm doing is the only one, although there will be multiple flights, so it's not like it's just one flight and done. Most of the people from my class actually just got back from Alaska, where they were doing, I hate to call it a dress rehearsal because it's not, but calibrating a lot of the equipment and testing a lot of the things that we're going to use on the actual space mission in a high-altitude aircraft. For this particular project, there have been multiple classes of scientist-astronaut candidates. I don't know exactly how many. I think there have been maybe three or four classes with anywhere from 8 to 12 people each.
Okay, what actual skills do you have to have? Because, well, hopefully everything's going fine and you'll basically just be doing this science stuff and piloting, but what sorts of, precaution tasks did you do? Like, as I said, on the video I've seen, recovering from a drowning aircraft or things like that, because I think that's, a super interesting thing to do.
Yeah, it's quite the experience. I've been through that twice, and I'm getting ready to go through it a third time in the spring, only this time in a spacesuit. Can't wait to see how that goes, but yeah, this place where we do that, they've got something they call the Dunker, and it's an aircraft simulator. And what they do is they plunge this thing into the water, and then it starts flipping upside down while you're in it, strapped to your seat. And you can't even tell what direction is up by the time they're done with you. And you have to get the door open, get yourself unstrapped, which half the time you're left hanging upside down underwater in the dark, and then find a way out. And then they'll do things to you like making you find a different door rather than the one that's right next to you. So you may have to go all the way across the cabin or something like that to get out. And then they can also introduce environmental simulations. So they can set this thing on fire, they can create wind, rain, all sorts of things. They might blindfold you for a run. And then after you've done this for a few days, then what they end up doing is taking you out to the North Atlantic. When I did it, it was the middle of winter, so it was really cold out. And they drop you in the Atlantic, and they give you a life raft, but the thing's not inflated and it's quite a distance away, so everybody has to link together and swim as a group against the waves and everything to get to this raft and then get it inflated, and it inflates upside down, so you have to be able to get it right side up and get everybody on board, make any repairs to the raft, and then start finding out if they give you a survival kit, what's in it, what you can use out of the kit to survive. And it's quite the intensive process.
Well, I think it is. Do you actually know how is it different from what the NASA astronauts do while they're preparing for their flights? Do they actually go through the same stuff?
I've been told that it's pretty much the same, but not having actually done the NASA version, I can't say for sure. But one of our instructors was from NASA, so I'm assuming that it's very similar.
Okay. So what about the zero-G flights?
Those are great.
Well, it's. I haven't done it myself, but I hope to do it one day. Can you actually tell us a bit like how it's done? I know it's a plane like going up and down all the time, but from an inside perspective, so how does it feel like, and what is it all about?
Well, the way that it feels, it's kind of an odd sensation because zero gravity comes from free fall. You accelerate towards the Earth at the same speed as gravity, so you can't just put the plane in a dive because eventually you'll hit terminal velocity and won't be going fast enough. They actually have to point it at the ground and use the engines to go fast enough to accelerate to the speed of gravity. So even though you're hurling towards the ground, there's absolutely no sensation of falling. You would never know that you're in free fall.
Well, that's basically what people do in orbit. They constant free fall.
Exactly. It's a strange feeling, but it feels completely natural at the same time. When you're first about to go weightless, it feels a lot like what you feel on a commercial airliner. When the pilot starts to begin their initial descent, they ease up on the throttle and put the nose down a little bit. It's that same sensation when you're about to go weightless. But no matter what position you're in, upside down, right side up, sideways, it feels as though you're upright. Your eyes are the only cue that maybe you're not straight up and down. You feel fully supported even when you're floating in midair. And the other weird thing about it is that your internal organs will shift position slightly within the limits of the connective tissue. So everything feels a little bit out of place. And normally when you're on the ground, you accumulate a lot of blood in your legs. But without gravity, all of that blood goes upwards. So your face swells up a little bit, your chest swells up a little bit. So you end up feeling a little bit stuffy, kind of like you've got a mild cold.
Do you actually have to perform some exercises, or do you just, you know, fly around in the plane?
Well, the first time that I did it, if we're not counting a plane that I was flying myself, the first time that I did a for real zero-G campaign, I was lucky in that it was a tourist flight, so I was able to just have fun. We did the thing where we flew like Superman through the cabin and let some M&Ms float around and just had a really great time. The ones that I've done since then, I've had tasks that I've had to do while I was floating. So one of them, I was what they call a subject assistant. On that particular flight, we were testing out a spacesuit and a chair that had been specifically designed for the spacecraft and the interface in between them. And my job on that flight was to keep an eye on the person in the spacesuit and just be there for them if they had a medical emergency or if they needed something. Another one that I did, I was mission director, so I was basically in charge of the entire flight on that one. And so the nice thing about that was that during the parts where we were weightless, I had a little bit of freedom to play around a little bit, but during the high G portion when we're going back up, I really had my hands full.
Okay. There is the thing I would also like to talk about, this multi-axis rotational thing where you have to sit inside, and I know that some people say that you can actually get used to that, so how was your experience? I mean, are you good with these things? Because I'm terrible with those. I would get sick like in the first minute or something like that.
It depends on which one we're talking about. I've done a few different ones. Was there a specific one that you had in mind?
Well, I would probably be sick in any of them. So
okay.
can you go through like different types? Because again, that's something that you don't really expect without like actually getting into the topic. So what kind of those rotational things do you do, and how are they different, and how can you actually, well, how do you feel yourself inside of those?
Okay, I did a NASA one several years ago that they call the multi-axis trainer. It's a series of three rings that spin inside of each other, and you're strapped to a seat in the middle of those three rings. And that one, it's actually not too bad while you're moving. The trick to not getting sick is to stare at something that doesn't move, like there was a bar over my head, so that's what I focused on. The only part of that one that's bad is when the machine stops, because when the machine stops, all of a sudden you don't have the tension off of those motors, so it goes into neutral and you actually start spinning a little bit faster. And that was kind of bad, but not enough to make me sick. But I also did something they call motion sickness desensitization training, and that one was brutal. I used something called the GyroLab. This was at the National Aerospace Training and Research Center. And this GyroLab, normally they use it for jet training. I've spent quite a bit of time in it doing spatial disorientation training and that sort of thing. But for motion sickness training, what they do is you're not flying it yourself. They've got somebody else at a remote station that doesn't move flying it for you. And you just strap in and enjoy the ride. But the whole goal is to make you sick over and over and over again, with the intention of that if they make you sick enough times, then hopefully you won't get sick anymore.
So is it actually like a training to make you, to train you to orient in space when you're like in some harsh conditions, when something goes out of control and you have to, you know, keep yourself oriented? Or is there any other purposes of this whole thing?
No, it doesn't really have anything to do with orientation, at least not the way that they used it with me. It's more about just building up a tolerance to motion sickness, because so many of the things that we do can make you really, really sick pretty quick. And motion sickness can actually become so severe that it becomes debilitating, and you certainly don't want that in the middle of a space flight.
Okay, so I would also like to point out that you have a lot of different videos on your training on your website, which we'll link in the description to this podcast, which you can find in the usual place, like in whatever app you're listening to or on our site. Just follow the links and see the videos. They're really cool, and I'm actually a bit jealous that I can go through it myself. And the last thing, you've done a lot of dives for that, right?
Yes.
So how is diving similar to you know, being in zero G? Because I've done a lot of dives myself, so I just want to, you know, compare the sensations and how well, or at least understand how those compare. And did you actually do any specific things while diving, like any training tasks or whatever?
Well, I'll answer the last part first. Not yet, but I'm going to be doing that in the spring. I mentioned that they're sending me back to sea survival training, but this time in a spacesuit. I'm not completely sure what they've got in store for me, but I know I'm going to be doing some underwater work in a spacesuit to kind of get used to that. But as far as how diving is similar to weightlessness, it's mostly the visual sensation that's similar. You know, because when you're diving, you can swim above the bottom, never actually touching the ground. You know, weightlessness is the same way. Diving, you can turn flips and that sort of thing, just like you can in weightlessness, but the similarity's kind of in there. Being weightless feels nothing like diving. When you're diving, if you do a head-first descent, you can feel the blood rushing to your head, you might feel the tank bumping you in the back of the head. You don't get any of that in weightlessness.
Oh crap, I thought I would feel what weightlessness is, but I didn't. that sucks a bit.
Well, if you want to feel what weightlessness is really like just for a split second, find a tall building that has an elevator, hit the down button, and as soon as it drops, jump up in the air and you'll feel weightlessness for a second.
Well, you can just, you know, dive into the water from something somewhere really high, which is also technically weightlessness because you're like in free fall. So you sort of can get the sense of how things are going, but I think it's the extended period of weightlessness which is interesting, rather than just a few moments of that.
Yeah, even in a small plane, though, if you fly yourself or if you know somebody who can take you up, you can fly small parabolas in something as small as a Cessna and get a few seconds of weightlessness.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll see if I can get to that, but that's certainly an experience to have in your life, and I think it's worth it. So I know there are actually commercial flights that do this whole weightlessness thing in a relatively large aircraft when they go up and down.
Yeah.
Which you can go for. So that if you have access to that, you probably should try that. So can anybody do that? I mean, are there any conditions that you have to pass? Well, like I know that with diving you have some sort of checklist that, you know, like you don't have any severe heart diseases and things like that.
Yeah, so they do have something like that.
Yeah, so I think it's still pretty normal. I mean, an average person can apply and go for that as long as you can afford it and you have something like that available.
Yeah, the biggest thing that they look for is to make sure that your heart is healthy, because when you're flying parabolas, there's a portion of the flight when you're ascending, and during the ascent phase, depending on the flight profile, you could be pulling anywhere from like maybe 1.8 to 2.5 Gs going up, and your heart has to work a lot harder during that phase, so that's one of the reasons why they're interested in heart health.
Okay. I think we can wrap this whole thing up. So what are the actual plans for emissions? So when can we expect it? What are the preliminary dates that are available now?
Originally, they were telling me probably July 2018 for the mission. At this point, I think that's probably going to depend on Virgin Galactic's readiness, because as I said, we were originally planning on using a different vehicle. My guess is it may end up slipping to 2019.
Okay, so it's still like pretty soon in space terms, right?
Oh, yeah.
So missions are usually planned for like tens of years, but this one is relatively soon, and hopefully it's not going to be shifted a lot, which sometimes happens. But
and there's still a lot of work to do on my part too. Before then, still a lot of training to go through. The next one that they're sending me off to is wilderness survival.
So is it like just in case you land somewhere?
Yeah, the mission takes place in the Arctic, so they're going to have me out in Colorado. Where it'll be nice and cold and be out in the wilderness for a few days. They haven't told me exactly what to expect yet, but I know they're going to be teaching survival, and they're also going to be combining that with a space medicine class, so we'll be learning medicine while we're out in the woods, I guess. I don't know.
Well, that sounds like fun. Do you know if you will go to the actual cold places? Like, will you go to the Arctic and see how it's there? Probably, you know, explore the pole or something like that?
Remains to be seen. Like I said, most of my classmates just got back from the Arctic doing a high altitude campaign. Unfortunately, I had a schedule conflict and wasn't able to go to that one, but I'm sure they're going to be doing that again.
Oh yeah, and the last question I wanted to ask, so how do people actually combine it with their jobs? Because, well, as far as I understand, that's not like an actual job, that's more like a hobby. Or so how is it actually, you know, how does it fit in people's lives?
It's tough. Time management is definitely a trick. It's kind of like having two full-time jobs.
Which is not very good, and I can tell you that. Do you actually get any sort of payment for that, or is it just, or do you pay for that, or so? How is it done financially?
It varies widely. It really depends on what it is that you're doing. Like, for example, the people that just did the trip up to the Arctic, I know it was heavily subsidized, but I'm not even clear what the terms were on that one.
Okay, but what about the actual flight? Is it funded by NASA or somebody else, or the company that organizes this whole thing? Because tourist flights, you have to pay for them, and I assume a lot of people would actually go for that if the prices are reasonable, and even if they're not, I think there still will be a number of people who will be willing to do that. So how does it all fit into the program that you're doing?
My understanding, and don't quote me on this, but I believe it's supposed to be covered. They're talking about selling media rights, and of course NASA has some funding for us and that sort of thing, so I know that there are going to be at least some of us that our flights should be covered. I don't know if that's going to be the case for everybody or just some, or it's one of those details that hasn't really been talked about all that much yet.
And do you know if Virgin Galactic is actually involved, or do they just provide the flight for you?
They're just going to be providing the flight for us.
Okay, so they're not into the scientific part of the mission in any sort of ways?
Not that I know of, but they're involved in other ways. Like when I did the centrifuge training, I actually did that at the place where Virgin Galactic does their centrifuge training.
Well, which makes sense, because you'll be using their ships, I think. So at least it makes sense for me. okay, and I think we can end here. I would like to wish you the best of luck with your mission, and hopefully you'll successfully complete it, and then you'll come to us again and tell us about your impressions and the results that you'll get, which is going to be super fun. So thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you for having me.
I hope to hear you again here, and hope to see you come back with a successful mission in your pocket.
Thank you. Yeah, I'd be happy to come back after I fly.
Ну а на этом все. Надеюсь, вам понравился этот выпуск. Независимо от того, слушали вы его на английском языке или же в переводе на русский. Обязательно пишите в комментариях, как вам вообще такой формат, когда мы переводим, потому что это очень трудозатратно, понадобилось очень много сил, чтобы это все организовать. Надеюсь, вам понравилось. Обязательно отпишитесь об этом в комментариях, либо же в Твиттере. В общем, в любом месте, где сможете до меня достучаться, это в принципе несложно. Ну а на этом все. До следующего четверга. Да пребудет с вами сила и пока-пока.
Слушайте больше интересных тем и новостей в других подкастах проекта BirdieCast. Мы рассказываем о науке и космосе в The Big Beard Theory, фитнесе и правильном питании в Beardie Building, о технологиях и гаджетах, сериалах, играх и фильмах в BirdieCast. Ссылки на все подкасты указаны в описании или на сайте birdiecast.com.